This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hey everybody, it's Aaron Norris with the Norris Group, and today we are with John Aronson. He is a general licensed contractor and manufacturer home contractor, and also a licensed real estate broker and manufactured home dealer. He's CEO of On the Level and Crest Backyard Homes, and his family has been focused on all things manufactured housing and ADUs for some time now. We'll get to that in a second. He's also the author of Backyard Home Guide, everything you need to know about building an accessory dwelling unit, also known as an ADU. So welcome, John.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, I want to say a huge thank you. You and your wife were so tremendously helpful when we were working on our chapter on accessory dwelling units back in September for our event, Cashing In on a Boom. This chapter caught me very off guard how much history I needed to know. I was reading legislation. you were just an extreme help. So thank you for helping me get through that process. You are a wealth of knowledge, sir.
Well, thank you very much. I learned it all from my wife.
Oh, did you? Okay.
We've actually grown up in the business together. So,
how did you get involved in this space?
What you mean with manufactured housing or with ADUs or both?
Well, let's start with manufactured housings. Yeah. How long have you been in the manufactured housing space, and why manufactured homes?
I kind of backed into it by default in 86. I had just moved down to San Diego County after having sold a business in Orange County. And after a couple of years, with five kids and a mortgage, it was just sheer desperation. I needed to get something going. I was in the boat business in Orange County for a number of years and got out of that industry and then moved to San Diego to kind of start a new life and raise my kids in a nicer environment. But the reality hit, and I had to get a job. So basically, I started working for a company that was selling manufactured housing-related components, primarily for foundation systems and earthquake bracing. And then one thing just led to another, and we just evolved from there. And over the past 32 years, it's been pretty much our bread and butter and our life.
So you fell into by accident, and you know, manufactured housing sort of has like it's sort of a dirty word. I don't know why. I definitely grew up thinking like, oh, manufactured housing. Why does it have such a bad reputation?
Well, it goes back a long way. Basically, the connotation comes from a trailer. They used to call them trailers. They used to the toters or the transporters that hauled them down the freeway referred to them as wobbly boxes. Yep. And that was probably about the best definition I ever heard, because back in the 60s and 70s, that's exactly what they were. They were just little, tin shacks, essentially. They weren't built very strong. They didn't really, they were more like an oversized recreation vehicle. And then through the years, they started morphing into what they are today, which are basically HUD compliant and UCB and ICBO compliant dwellings that are built to the same standards that site built housing is. In fact, today they're built even much better than site built housing.
Really?
In most instances, yes.
How's
most
that?
Definitely. Well, it's materials. It's a materials and environment. Indoor environment is a lot more hospitable than outdoor. Outdoor is a lot more hostile to building components. You've got a problem with termites. You've got a problem with pilferage. You've got a problem with warping, waste, all the above. And with factory-built housing, by today's standards, it's all about environment. And it's all about the quality of materials. The lumbers that most if not all manufacturers use now are kiln-dried lumber. Mm-hmm. So it's nice and straight. It's not going to warp and crack like so much site-built wet wood does. And as a general and manufacturer home contractor, we do both. I really have no prejudice against site built. It's just that having been in manufactured housing and seen it evolve the way it has for the last 30 plus years, I've just come to really, really feel comfortable and confident that it's a good product.
Well, I think a lot of listeners are going to be a little bit newer to, and I was confused even researching this. There's some key, let's throw out some definitions so we're all speaking the same language. So manufactured homes are under Title 25 in California law. What? How do you define a manufactured home these days?
Well, basically it's they're built on the almost, I mean, they're pretty much on the, built on the same assembly line as a modular home. And there's very little difference. When you see them going down an assembly line, you really can't tell one from the other, other than the manufactured home is built on its own chassis and it's shipped on its own running gear and it's installed with the mainframe in place and not to be removed. And then it's set up on a series of pier jacks and pads, either wood or plastic or sometimes cement. And then it's basically skirted, and it goes under the what they call the HUD mandate, Title 25. They regulate it. So, from a practical standpoint, as a homeowner looking to put a very inexpensive ADU on their property, manufactured versus modular versus site built is probably the most economical in the overall scheme of things. It's just a lot less turnaround time. You don't have to mess with all the local city ordinances. It's basically under the HUD mandate, which supersedes the local jurisdiction.
And that is something important to know for sure. Okay. Well, and then real quick. So modular then would be sort of stick built. That's just built offsite. So it's prefab. Is that a good way to define it?
Well, no. A prefab basically is what they refer to as a flat stack, which is a series of floor, wall, and roofing components that are flat stacked on a low bed trailer, transported to the job site, and then erected in place, more or less constructed. But they're prefabricated from the standpoint that you don't have to build it from the ground up. So that there is a difference between prefab and total factory built. The HUD, by contrast to a modular meaning that it's built the same way, but it's not built on its own frame and chassis or running gear. In fact, it doesn't have a running gear. It's just built with a bottom plate, and then it's hoisted on by crane or rolled on by a series of rollers to a low boy trailer, and then it's hauled to the job site, and it's either rolled on or crane lifted and set onto a poured-in-place continual footing wall, much like a site-built home on a raised foundation. And then they're anchored. The home is actually anchored to the footing. So it's a permanent installation.
And those fall under Title 24 in California, right?
Those are Title 24, and they're all basically it's all geared towards local jurisdiction. So a modular would have to comply with the same local ordinances as a site-built home would, with the exception of a few less inspections, because if a modular unit comes with enclosed walls, then there's no way an inspector is going to be able to see the nail patterns or the anchor bolts or the tie downs or any of the things that they usually look for when inspecting the site-built structure. But then those are all done at the factory so that the inspector on site doesn't have to do that.
Yeah, and I think there's a conversation in California about labor, especially skilled labor, and some of the benefits that are emerging for prefab and modular. It's in controlled environments. It's environmentally friendly because of waste, and it ends up on site and can get put together faster than if you're doing stick built. But those key terms are really important as well, because now we're going to talk about accessory dwelling units, and it can be any of those three things. I think that's what got a little bit confusing. I'm like, oh, Title 24, 25, what's city regulated, what's mandated by HUD? It's there's a lot to follow here.
There is minutia that you've got to wade through, there's no doubt. But those are two really, I would say, far superior options in site built. We're leaning more towards modular and manufactured every day because of the a lot of the challenges that go along with a site built product. Now, having said that, there are instances where you have no choice but to go site built, where access becomes a problem, mm-hmm. ingress and egress. If a crane won't work, if there's high tension lines or high trees, or the boom to reach ratio is such that, and versus the weight of the component is such that it would be too dangerous to use a crane for fear that the crane may tip. And there's no room on either side or in the rear of the home, the primary residence, then you'd have no choice but to either use a flat pack prefab or go with a complete ground up.
Well, and some people just might not know all those different options exist. And I think I was very interested to watch Amazon this year invest in a Fontana-based prefab manufacturer. And then, of course, Clayton Homes is owned by Berkshire Hathaway, which is, of course, a Warren Buffett company. So there's some pretty big names getting into this space. So I have a feeling that 2019 might be the year that some of this really takes off, especially in California, considering the accessory dwelling unit conversation. Are you feeling the same?
Oh, absolutely. No, I was delighted. I was as delighted to see Warren Buffett acquire Clayton as I was to see him buy all that Apple stock.
Well, it shows their commitment to housing, and that I'm. If you haven't taken the time to look at Clayton Homes and the level of finish, for all intents and purposes, you can often not tell the difference between stick built and some of the new manufactured homes. And I can understand now why you, when you say trailer, why you get sort of a dirty look from people that are in the space. So it's definitely changed.
Our biggest adversary. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No. Your biggest adversary is what?
Our biggest adversary are site-built contractors. Those are our competitors. Mm. And they talk trash, basically, about any kind of modular or manufactured type of construction. Okay. So they're always putting it down, whereas we're neutral because we do both, and I don't have anything against site built. I don't have anything against modular or manufactured. We go strictly by what the customer can afford or what they want and what is most practical for that particular project.
I think that's what was really fun, why it was fun to work with you on the specific chapters, because you were fine talking about either. It wasn't pro or con either way, and that's really helpful when considering some of these projects. You can look at them and say, this is going to be best for you and your budget and what's going to be fastest. It's good to know. Well, let's dig into the ADU part. So how would you define an ADU?
Well, it's by definition, as you know, it's an accessory dwelling unit, which is added livable space, and allowable space permitted by your local jurisdiction to be installed on your property. It's designed with, there's various reasons and motives that people put them on their property. A lot of folks just want a little accessory unit that they could use as recreationally. If they have a pool, they call it a pool house. Or a little cabana next to the patio just for barbecuing and sitting outside and enjoying the environment. Or it gets down to brass tacks where you have an aging parent, or you may be aging yourself and you want to move out of downsize, as they say. That's the new buzzword, the ADU biz. I'd say the biggest percentage of people want to downsize. They like where they live, want to age in place, but they just don't need the responsibility and the obligation of having to maintain a large dwelling. So they one of two choices: they'll either sell it and then live in their ADU on site in the environment that they've been used to for many years, or they'll work out some kind of an arrangement with the family member to move in and maintain the property and allow them to stay on the property and live in the ADU, or as we call it, backyard home. And then there's always the need for folks with larger properties that have a full-time caretaker to tend to the property, and then possibly somebody that tends to the inside of the home. There's a lot of those scenarios out there. And then there's a lot of folks that just can't, you know, like college students and young couples that are still living at home, and they want to start a family of their own. And, you know, mom and dad don't want to have them all living under the same roof. So if they've got the space on their property, they'll put an ADU on the property for that purpose. So there's myriad reasons and motivations for it. But I'd say primarily, and then there's those folks that just want to capitalize on just leveraging the property below their feet that they own. You know, they want to be able to garner an additional revenue stream, so they add an ADU. And that, by and large, is becoming very big with a lot of investors.
Yeah.
They're looking at. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why we wanted to cover this chapter. And there's a few different opportunities. There's the flip, which we'll get to the pros and cons later, and the rental side. There's the short-term rental piece. And, you know, back in 2016 is when this really got started, and Governor Jerry Brown actually signed a bill at the state level. And the motivation was that California just hasn't been producing enough housing stock, or more specifically, affordable housing stock for people. And the official definition, according to the Assembly Bill 495, was it shall include permanent provisions for living, sleeping, eating, cooking, and sanitation. And the reason why I wanted to cover that was a lot of cities are dealing with this in a different way. There are some cities who are very upset that the state decided to get in this space. We're now through two rounds of regulation. We interviewed late last year Senator Wachowski, and he told us on air that he wasn't done yet, so expect more in 2019. But to finally to finish up the definitions, there's also the JADU, so the junior accessory dwelling unit. How would you define that?
Well, that basically is one of two things. It's either a conversion that you do within the footprint of your existing structure, your primary residence. In other words, you take one of your bedrooms that has an adjoining bathroom, and by definition, an ADU or a JADU has to have its own ingress and egress, its own access from the outside, and it has to have at least an adjoining bathroom. And then a kitchen, or more specifically, a kitchenette is basically what it usually ends up being with a JADU scenario, given the space you have to work with, unless you have an exceedingly large room. Or that's option number one. Or you can do a room addition and expand beyond the existing footprint of your primary residence and build another room that has all those same elements.
Mm-hmm. So
it's
exciting, and a lot of people don't know this is what's regulated by the state. And basically, the state said if you don't have whatever you had prior to 2017 is null and void, it's going to default to the state unless you create a new ordinance, and that would go into effect in 2018. And there was very specific guidelines. I think I got that right. Everything went into effect in 2018. Is that correct?
Well, Senate Bill 1069 and Assembly Bill 2299, I think it was, mm-hmm. went into effect January 1st of 2017.
Oh, that's right, 2017.
Then, yeah, subsequently, 2018, they just basically implemented, I think it was Senate Bill 1226, which deals with retrofitting non-permitted or non-conforming ADUs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so they regulated at the state level. So if the cities don't have one, and a lot of them didn't, it defaulted to the state level. And the state level is pretty generous with the size of the ADU. The whole point was to lower the barriers to entry, and by right, a property owner has the right to build an accessory dwelling unit, not have any onerous parking regulation. It was just there to smooth the path to make this easier so people could get more housing units up as quickly as possible. I think from sort of how I took it. The state was not very happy with how cities were layering on a bunch of fees for schools and utilities, which was not the intent. And to the tune of oftentimes five figures for some of these permits and fees. And so that's one of the reasons that you've been seeing additional regulation, because they're like, no, you can't do that. And this is why, and this are the regulations. So it's interesting. Unfortunately, it's confusing because every city is handling this differently. You have to see the fine print. Sometimes there's history overlays. There's some ways they can still get around it. So you really have to make sure you're not buying properties, assuming you could just go in and build whatever you want. Is that one of the mistakes you're seeing? Right.
People. No, you nailed it. I this young lady that's involved with the San Diego Creative Investors Association and has been for quite some time, and I are going to be working on a cost analysis for where and when it's really practical to address an ADU on the basis of ROI. Or a cap rate that you can actually realize a return on your investment with. I contend that the jury's out on that. I don't ever advocate that in any of my presentations to people. If they say, look, I want to do this for investment, I want to make money on my ADU, I go, well, you better sharpen your pencil and make sure that you followed in the formula, or you could be sorely disappointed. And I think a lot of that is just based on how much equity somebody has in their home, what their debt to income ratio is, what their loan to value ratio is. I'm talking real estate broker speak, because I am a real estate broker as well. Mm-hmm. But I mean, those are all the things that you have to take into consideration before you just go, take out a bunch of money to build an accessory dwelling unit. It's ideally suited for investors that go into it with both eyes open, knowing that they're buying a property that they fully intend to add an additional unit on for income purposes. But for a young family or for mom and dad to just think that they can go put an ADU on their property and turn around and start generating income on it, you got to really do the math. It could really hurt you.
Yeah, I've heard some feedback that flips and ADUs are a little bit on a plus side. If an investor is buying a flip and they're going in and they're adding an ADU because they're already in the space, the ADU is going to match the new home. It's a creative way to do it, and it's like adding square footage. And I've heard that some appraisers are giving a square footage value just across the board. So the appraisals have been coming in, but because of the lack of comparables in some of the communities, appraisals can be a challenge. And then you've also got the banks. Your wife appraisal is in the finance part.
And comps. I mean, that's synonymous, because your appraisal has to kind of, comply with the comps in the area. So, that it all works hand in hand. And you're right. If you're in an area where there's a lot of single family residences, but no ADUs, and, sometimes the appraisers are thrown at a bit of a loss as to how to go about calculating it out.
Well, I knew this was going to happen. This is a beefy show. Let's take a break, and we'll come back for the second show and dig a little bit more into the finance and the appraisal part. So we'll be right back.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.